Hello, you're now listening to the Modem Podcast, where we deconstruct, examine, and discuss deeply technical data networking and information technology topics. Sit back and relax while we fire up Dial D and the 9600 baud modem and connect to the Wildcat BBS.
Hello, and welcome to Season 3, Episode 2 of the Modem Podcast. I am your host today, Chris Cummings, and with me is John Osmond and Nick Braulio. Today, we're kind of going to dip from our own well and talk about IPv6 multi-homing. And why I say we're going to dip from our own well is we're actually going to have Nick kind of play the role of guest in a way where we make bad decisions and invite weird guests, apparently. So the whole idea here is that Nick has been working in the ITF on, a bunch of IPv6 stuff related to the standards process. But one particular draft that Nick's been working on is related to IPv6 multi-homing. So since nobody probably wants to listen to me blather on for too long, how about we start off with introductions? John, how about you go off and introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm John Osmond. I'm in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I don't really know what I'm doing here. I'm just going to follow along and do what we can to help you guys out.
You're here because you know things about IPv6 and you know things about multi-homing. So that seems like a good reason to me.
I'll go with that one.
All right, we'll go with that one. And Nick, how about you?
Man, no one have that guy back on. He's the worst guest. I'm doing good. I'm doing well. I'm here about a mile and a half, 5 miles, however far I am from Chris. We're basically in the same town, but we live in different houses.
Well, sometimes. it is, I don't know, it's kind of gray today, man. Yeah, it is like starting to become spring, you know, like we're on season 3 of Modem. It's nice to be on, I can't believe it's been it's been 2 seasons. We're currently on 3, episode 2. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. Our little pandemic darling has continued, right? I think it's still good. I don't know. Maybe it's not.
I think it sucks.
It's great.
I think it sucks, but that's only because you're involved.
Fair point.
So, all right, on topic. Let's talk about IPv6 multi-homing. Just like a little bit of context, IPv6 is just the new version of IP, or some would say the current version of IP. So why do we have to take special provisions for multi-homing IPv6? Why don't we just do what we did in IPv4 and just call it a day? I mean, it's just an updated version of the protocol. Can I just do all the same shit? Same stuff I did before?
It's funny that you ask. I mean, that's a relevant question to something I've been thinking about lately. So this is something that is a little bit, it's one of the sort of dark corners of IPv6, right? Because the way that it was designed originally was hierarchically. And because of that, allocations and how things work are just a little bit different. However, there's this gigantic elephant in the room that allows for some things in V4 to be, I don't want to say easier, but I mean, frankly, that's correct. They're a little bit easier because it's such a simplistic mess of a protocol that you can do some things with it. Now, when you say multi-homing IPv6 and why does it have to be different? For the service provider and the folks that are on the in the space where they run BGP, they run a routing protocol, they participate in the default free zone and the global route table, it is the same, right? I mean, it's a bigger address, right? It's 128 bits, so you have to you can listen to our previous podcast with Ed, and we talk about TCAM utilization and why that's different with IPv6. So, but for routing in the global internet, it's really not that different, right? It's just another address family. You can even do IPv6 over IPv4 peerings and vice versa if you really want to do that kind of thing. Where it gets really, where it gets hairy and dicey is when you start getting into the SOHO space or the big enough to need redundancy or diversity, but not big enough to have a network engineering staff or maybe a whole lot of money to buy resources, or maybe even you're in a remote location where you can't get, a provider that'll do protocols with you. That's where it starts to devolve very, very, I mean, it's a cliff. You basically just go, I can do BGP or I can just walk up this cliff. Right. and that's kind of what we're trying to highlight.
So, would it be maybe some background that I'll maybe add some color here is like, when we think about IPv6, I always think it's important to kind of remember that V6 was, it's been around a while. A very long time, right? And so it was around before like DHCP, right? Like that's why you have Slack. So it's interesting to me to see a lot of these problems that kind of got solved or got created during the time in between when IPv6 was, you know, defined and where we are now with deployments. And so I would say like, you know, multi-homing back in the olden days, right? When V6 first came out. Like you mentioned, it was pretty easy, like for service providers and stuff, you just run BGP because that's how you just ran, IP, right? And there really wasn't like this, and correct me if I'm wrong, I wasn't around for as much of it, but like there really wasn't this class of network that was like, I run a network and I don't run BGP, or at least like if I am one of those networks, like I don't need redundancy and my internet service providers just hand me off like a LAN that has public addresses, right? Because V6 was in the day of end-to-end addressing, right? There was no concept really too much of NAT, right? I mean, that was a band-aid to be put onto IPv4 to kind of get us through this whole time, right? So I guess I would sit to ramble a little bit. I guess what I'm saying is that you didn't really have a problem of like small entities needing to multi-home, right? Nowadays, like if you're a coffee shop, right? You have a point of sale system that needs to get out to the internet. And that point of sale system, like if it's not working, you're not making money. It didn't really used to be that way, right? Like you didn't need an internet connection to do that. And so now, you know, IPv6 comes out, adoption is very slow. And then in the meantime, the IPv4 internet evolves to become much more relied upon, I guess, is how I'd kind of say it. And so now you have all of these small offices, small businesses, homes even, that need redundant internet connectivity and need to get to the internet regardless of the status of one of their providers. And we've come up with a lot of hacks to do that in IPv4, right? So maybe you want to talk about some of the ways that we do redundancy in V4. John, Nick, you know, I can give some too if you want. But like the first one that comes to mind is like, you know, a ping test that fails over a static route, right? And updates NAT and all that stuff, right? Just for a small home office, like a small, not necessarily a home office, but actually, yeah, my home office. Yeah. Like for V4, that's how I fail over.
Or less script. Automated. Less yeah. Automated. It might be physically somebody plugging in the second connection and
yes.
Doing something like a floating route or something like that so that when it's plugged in, it works. And when everything, you know, when your primary people are working, you unplug it again.
And maybe one good thing to point out that I guess we haven't really said, but we've talked around, but we maybe have assumed people understand, like the reason that works in V4 land is because, you know, you're using private address space and you are NATing that out no matter what, basically. Right. So you don't have to worry about renumbering your internal network when your upstreams change in IPv4, even if you don't run BGP or any of that stuff. So maybe talk about like briefly then folks, just like, you know, kind of some ways that we would do this in legacy IP.
Yeah. I mean, I think you hit a bunch of important points like all along that path. One, you know, and I just want to touch on this because someone will say, well, IPv4 does this and it's, you know, whatever. All that stuff is bolt-on crap that was made because there was a problem with the initial protocol. DHCP, bolt-on. All that's, you know, VLSM, frankly, bolt-on, right? Yeah. I mean, all that stuff is just bolted on to a legacy protocol to sort of, you know, make it the $6 million bionic man to have a great, that's a 70s reference for Jay there. It's not 80s for Jay Stewart.
I mean, the point you're also getting here, it's a byproduct of really the NAT world that we put together to save ourselves a space, you know, to be able to put an endpoint and multiplex multiple IP addresses beyond it. You know, take an entire network and proxy it through one piece. I mean, those are the pieces that we run into issues all the time. Do you want proxy internet like NAT is? or do you want real connectivity? For a lot of people, they don't care what the difference is.
And
they
right.
It doesn't mean anything.
And that's another thing is like, there's, you know, I know I've probably told this anecdote a million times now on the podcast here, but like there's a whole class of engineer that doesn't like really grok the concept of an end-to-end internet, an end-to-end internet. Right. And I definitely was one of those for a while. Like I remember the first time I actually saw, I think I've told this many times, like a public IP, in the wild on an end host. And I like, you know, I kind of freaked out a bit. I was like, oh no, like this host is like going to get compromised. It's on the internet. And like, I was so worried. And then like, I went to go print something and I saw a printer with a public IP and I just, you know, it was hysterical. Right. And so
that's how John and I learned.
Right. That's how the internet's supposed to work. That's the original idea, the end-to-end principle. And like, I feel like we forget that. And not to go, I guess, off the deep end, but like, you know, there are people that are arguing that end-to-end is dead. Right. And you don't need it anymore. Right. Because the internet's moved to such a, like kind of centralized client server model that you don't need this peer-to-peer reachability. I personally disagree with that, but yeah, I would agree with John. I think your statement that, you know, a lot of this is really just a byproduct of how the needs of the networking community changed, I think, after V6 came out, and it was plastered over a lot with NAT and IPv4.
But and it so doesn't now, really solve the problem because you still
no, get it doesn't.
That the endpoint that you're proxying through still needs to be multi-homed in some fashion in order for you to be able to survive, you know, an upstream outage.
Right.
Right. Yeah, and exactly. And I think what happens is it's enabled, right? It enables that. It's a byproduct of the fact that you never have to change your internal addressing. Now, Chris, you said something, and then John, you kind of said it too, that's important. And I want to restate it. It's that the internet, it changed during the course of time. I mean, since the 90s, right? Or actually really the 80s, but like kind of when it really started to blossom in the 90s, we're like, oh, now like my mom and dad can get a dial-up modem at their home, right? But it was still novelty at that point. Where the inflection point lies is when it essentially became an expected utility, right? And I don't want to get into the whole net neutrality utility, you know, definition or whatever, but from a pragmatic standpoint, if you go to someone's home or if you're in your own home, there is a very high chance that you just expect that there is internet access there, right? Doesn't matter how it gets there. It could be on your cell phone, right? The availability of online content is expected almost as much as it is to have, you know, running water and electricity in the modern, you know, civilization. And that's what sort of changed during that time frame. And V6 was very early, but it didn't really have that. I don't think anybody in the world really expected it to do what it did, right? Mm-hmm. And so now we're kind of having to play some of the same games that we did with V4, right? Backporting things and patching stuff.
Running water is such a great example because, like, you know, you used to have like your own cistern, you know, to store up water, right? In times that the supply wasn't going to be available. And like now, like, man, I've moved all my music to a streaming service, right? Because it's so convenient, right? So, and honestly, I don't even download to my devices half the time, even though my streaming service allows me to do that just because I've gotten incredibly lazy and it just works. Like it always works. And then like
exactly
every now and then the rare event will happen where like I'm somewhere without internet connection. I'm like, oh, I didn't download that, did I? And like, it's pretty amazing how that paradigm has shifted just, you know, really even more in the past like 5 years to where like internet connectivity with cellular has gotten so reliable and available where like I pay like $30 a month for an unlimited cellular plan. I don't have to worry about data caps anymore and that stuff. And so like the internet is becoming so much more ubiquitous and relied upon that like it has to work basically for any technology to work. So I think that leads in pretty well to why, you know, you folks are working on, you know, a draft to make multi-homing in V6 more, you know, maybe address some gaps that are there. So maybe you want to go into what the gaps are that you have identified, even the folks working on this have identified in multi-homing with V6. I mean, we've kind of talked about why it's a problem, but maybe just kind of give us the synopsis of your draft. And
yeah, so really the draft is to point out like these are the options that are available and deployable today, right? And if you go and we'll link to the draft, but like if you go and read the draft, you'll see that none of them are really very good as far as like supportability goes. And the reason for that is exactly the reason that we've just said. In IPv4, your source address selection from your host never needs to change on an internal network, especially if you're using NAT, an address translation, which 99% of the IPv4 world is, there's a NAT somewhere in that path. V6 has been ardently against that. You know, there is an RFC for NPT, which is a form of address translation. It's really sort of, I'll probably get, you know, scorned for making this analogy, but it really, to me, if you're making a analogy to IPv4, it's like one-to-one NAT, right? So This exact address translates to this exact address. And that's functionally what NPT does at a very high level, right? We can be pedantic about it, but we're not going to, right?
So kind of like the old days of like, you know, I'm looking at this shelf of books that John has behind his head, like all these Cisco Press books. Like I remember when I first was learning how to do NAT for like CCNA or something like that. It was like, at first it was just like, you would do a one-to-one translation of like, you know, 10.0.0.0/24 to 192.168.0/24, you know, yep. With the concept of like mergers and acquisitions. So NPT was kind of like very similar to that you're saying, right?
Right. But it essentially, there's no state tracking. And that's the key to remember here. There's no state tracking involved, which means it functionally preserves end-to-end reachability because it's really only translating the last part of the address. Mm-hmm. That exists. That exists as an option. The problem with that is that as you see through the draft, it's the source address selection from the host. In IPv6, it's significantly more complex than IPv4. And we talked about this in the ULA show, and I've talked about it on IPv6 Buzz. And you know, it's a well-traveled problem that unique local addressing just sucks as a deployable, supportable platform because it's inconsistently implemented and there's some ambiguity in some of the verbiage in RFC 6724, which is being worked on. But the root problem is that if you want addressing that never changes, you have to do one of two things. You have to assign, well, one of three things, really. You have to assign PI space, like global address space that is not ULA. You get it from wherever. You can make it up if you want, right? I wouldn't advise doing that because, you know, you don't want to walk on existing things, but there are ways to do it, right?
But does the DoD have an IPv6 prefix
like a squad on? Yeah. Like a 7./8. Yeah. You can do that or you can do ULA, but when you do ULA, you're stuck with the problem of source address selection being messy and really inconsistent across different platforms. Like I can't tell my Apple Mac device what my local prefix is. I have never figured out a way to do that. If somebody knows how, I would love to know. Or you take like what I've done is I own a PI block of my own space. So I allocated myself a /48 and I've numbered things out of that. And I can do NPTv6 to that if I really want to.
So I guess a lot of this is coming from the perspective of I don't want to change my, you know, local network addressing, right? Renumbering is hard and all that stuff. So I'll ask a question for the sake of the devil's advocacy. Isn't V6 supposed to just work like that? Like, aren't I supposed to be able just to have as many prefixes as I want on my server or my host or my iPhone or my whatever, right? Like, why don't we just use that?
And you can. You can definitely do that. However, because V6 is significantly more complex, in my testing of this, and again, I'm not claiming to be like the be all, the end all of, you know, I don't have all the answers, right? And I'd be happy to be wrong about this because it would mean that I could have something that I actually want. But, and I've tried this, right? So I got two prefix delegations, one from my fiber provider and one from a cable provider. I can even set precedent on the RAs if I want to, which I do. but it's all about source address selection, right? There's always going to be a, if IPv6 is implemented correctly, like IPv4 is, and you have BCP38 running, meaning you can't spoof addresses that are not meant to be announced from a network through a network, then if you try to use an address block that is available, if it chooses that as your source and it tries to send that out the other internet provider, then it will there'll be a failure timeout. I mean, it's pretty quick, but it's annoying, right? We shouldn't have to deal with that. And I don't think that from a usability standpoint, like from an enterprise or from like someone who works at home that just needs redundant internet access, but may not be, and maybe they're a lawyer, right? Maybe they're not technical. Like not everybody's technical like us. And I think a lot of people forget in this industry that not everybody we have a very let them eat cake attitude about yeah, some of these definitely. Things, right? Like my mom and dad aren't going to know how to do this. They don't even know what IPv6 is, right? They just know I can't get to
the. If we do it right, they shouldn't know how to. I mean,
exactly.
When I get into these conversations, I think that the real answer is we need to go step back and build a new transport protocol that underneath it can use IPv4 or IPv6 simultaneously in multiple, you know, with multiple connections.
Well, and I think like MTC, like MTCP is like a good excellent like step in the direction. Cause like, you know, I know it works well with multiple interfaces. I don't know how it works with multiple addresses on an interface, but like, yeah, like if you can actually keep your TCP session up across, that would be a big deal. But yeah, so I guess, you know, it's not as easy as just, well, yeah, just throw a bunch of different RAs out there, set RA precedents. Like, because the other thing too is, and this relates back to our ULA stuff we've talked about, like you're still going to want to have consistent numbering on your LAN in some ways, even with V6. You know, you're still using DNS. You're not typing in these, you know, IPs by hand necessarily, but like you still need consistent addressing for a lot of like, especially server systems, right? And so because ULA doesn't work for that, and it won't ever really be selected in a dual stack network, like we're kind of left without an option to do a lot of this, I guess, huh?
Yeah, it's just so, I guess the real takeaway is it's way more complicated to do this than it should be. Mm-hmm. And that's really kind of one of the things that the draft sort of indirectly says is that, you know, sure, you've got these options, right? I can do ULA with NPT. I can do, you know, ULA with NAT66 if we want to. The problem is that the complication shifts around depending on what your deployment model is, right? If you're going to do ULA at all, then you're stuck with the whole problem of source address selection, where if you're also running V4, which there is a 99% chance that anybody that's going to want to do this is also going to be running V4, right? It's very infrequent that you're going to see some, oh yeah, I don't run V4 at home, right? They're not, or I don't run V4 in my small bakery or whatever the hell they're doing, right? You're never going to use V6. So what's the point, right? Unless there are V6 only resources out there, which, I mean, sure, maybe there are some, but like, let's be realistic. Like we want both of them to work. I want all the cake and I also want to eat it. And I should be able to do that, right? If we're going to stick with this cake analogy here.
Now I want cake, but I guess too, like you get into like embedded devices and stuff like that. Like, I mean, can you... My question is RA precedence accepted? Is it supported on all platforms?
Oh, I was going to go into that.
Yeah, because yeah, so if it, there, like from an in-host standpoint, is it supported on all platforms to be able to access?
I would be so bold as to say it is not. It is not honored all across the board. I think that's pretty safe. It should be, right? I mean, it's in the, you know, there's lots of things that should be done in the real, you know, in the real networking world that just practically speaking are not, because they've never been tested. Right. And so, you know, unless vendors are going out and they're doing extensive IPv6 testing, which newsflash, most of them aren't. I've run into, you know, I've worked with vendors that say, well, we've never even had anybody turn V6 on before. And you're just like, okay, well, let's do that and see what happens and we'll help you fix it. But, you know, I think that, you know, the only way that I've been able to make this work, let's do a case study here. And we'll talk about the way that I've done this at my house, right? Which is a very tip, you know, I have a home office here. I've got a bunch of, you know, I'm lucky enough that I have a whole bunch of different internet options. So I've had multiple providers in my home for almost the entirety of time I've lived here, which is almost 20 years. So at the very minimum, I had DSL and cable, right? DOCSIS-based cable. And right now I have DOCSIS-based cable and gig fiber. And both of them, I'm lucky enough that both of them provide me IPv6. So you're probably thinking, fantastic, you've got lots of options. Sure, on paper. Let's start thinking through those options, right? If we want to do NPTV6, I could just take one of the more stable, or take the more stable of the two prefix delegations and say, these are my internal addresses. And I'm making a big assumption here that that PD does not change, which newsflash, they do all the time. They probably do more than they should. But on both of my prefix delegations, I have a lease time of 2 days. Now, typically, the fiber one doesn't change. It's mostly been the same. For months will go by and it will never change. So, okay, let's say I number everything out of that fiber prefix delegation, which is a /56. By the way, most service providers, the recommendation is like a /56. That is not honored, I would say 80% of the time.
What about my 8/64s I can get from AT&T that aren't
right? So contiguous. Well, AT&T gives you 1/64 by default on their fiber, and probably the same thing on their. I think it is the same on their DSL. That's actually, last time I had it,
that's just useless.
There are some yes, and so there's a bunch of hoops you can jump through to grab up to what, 7 more /64s. Now, for anyone running, I hope someone from AT&T is listening to this. That sucks from a usability perspective.
It's terrible.
Granted, again, this is a very let them eat cake attitude where we have more than one segment at our homes because we're highly technical and probably most people don't, and 164 is enough. However, it still blows because it's 1/64 and maybe some people don't want to run your CPE as their border. So if we could standardize on /56, that'd be freaking amazing.
And I mean, okay. Most home routers have guest networks built in, all that stuff where it's right. Just a checkbox. Like there's no, yep. Yeah, it's really irresponsible, but I'll digress.
It stinks from a usability standpoint. Okay. So rant aside, my other provider is Comcast, right? It's just a residential Comcast line. It's the lowest package available, the cheapest I can get. It's basically just a backup. They give me a /60. By default, I think they give me a 64 unless I ask for a 60, in which case, or unless I ask for anything bigger than a 64 and then I get a 60. Right away, you're going to see those prefix, they don't match, right? So doing NPT from one to the other is already a chore, right? Because you got to sit down, you got to do math, you got to know what you're doing, right? And let's be honest, even seasoned people are going to have to scratch their head a little bit and go, okay, hang on, let's see what bits we have to shift here to sort of map this into that. And yeah, maybe it's easy for some people, but I hate math and I would have to sit down and I'd be angry for a half an hour after I had to do that, right? And I've been doing V6 for 20 years and I'm like, this sucks. I don't want to do this. And couple that with the fact there is a huge amount, I would say the majority of CPE does not do NPT. So you can do OpenWRT or, one of the open source platforms, or maybe you're savvy and you just run a Linux box, or you've got pfSense in there if you like having a GUI or OpenSense or whatever the, flavor of the day is of the senses. And maybe you can do it with those, right? I'm pretty sure you can do it with all those three. But that is a fraction of a percent of deployments of real world broadband CPE out there.
Yeah. Can I do it with my Netgear Batman router? Like,
exactly.
I mean, probably that's the not. Kind of stuff. No. Yeah. I mean, I was helping.
I can't even do it with a microtik. I mean, I can do it with a microtik if I use NetMap, but it's ugly and it's painful and I don't want to do it. Right. It's not straightforward. And that right there hinders deployment. Right. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. As soon as it becomes more painful to set it up than it is perceived benefit, then people aren't going to do it. It needs to be easy. So NPTV6 with anything is, until that becomes easy, is probably off the table, right? For anyone that is not highly technical. And I'll just flat out say it, like, that's probably a non-starter. So then what are you left with? I can do one provider, and then I can do, like John said earlier, I can do a manual flip to the other one. I've tried that too. I wrote some stuff on the MikroTik that will actually just switch which pool the PDs come from once you know, once upstream connectivity to one or the other is removed. But again, that's scripting. Like, I shouldn't have to do that. I can do it, sure. Yeah, I mean, I can probably build my own airplane in my garage too, but I'm not gonna. Right? It just doesn't make any sense. It's too difficult to do. It's okay. What's left after that?
I've got it. Just run BGP.
Oh yeah. I mean, I have an ASN. I have a /40 of my own PI address space. That would be wonderful. I would love to do that. And hey, frankly,
call up Comcast, call up your residential provider and just pure BGP with them. Good grief.
Right.
Like, why are you making it so difficult?
I know. For my $25 a month DOCSIS cable modem, I'm sure they're going to be jumping at the chance to run a routing protocol that probably their first and second level engineers don't ever get to touch. Right?
The whole multi-routing internet has been built on it since, you know, when 80, when did BGP4 come out?
86? 88?
Somewhere in there. I mean, it's been working fine with that since, you know, since almost the dawn of time. Why aren't we just telling people that if you want to have this type of redundancy, that's what you do?
Well, we do tell them that. We do tell them that. But like, I'm glad you brought that up, John, because here's a couple other little fun facts. Here's a little couple tidbits for you guys, which you already know, I'm sure. But one, like, you know, the delicious taco restaurant down the street that needs their point of sale system on the internet is not going to do that. They don't even know what that means, right? They know how to make freaking delicious tacos and burritos and tortas and nachos.
This sounds like a perfect place for a managed service provider to step in and do it all for them. So this will all work out, Nick. We'll just pay people to do it and it'll be
fine.
Let's
just say that we can do that, right? For the sake of argument, let's just say everybody that needs this redundancy, we're going to just, they have endless money. And they can buy their resources from their local RIR or their regional RIR, and you know, Bob's your uncle, you're all done, right? Well, you gotta pay a MSP to come set this up for you. So first of all, you gotta find an MSP that's like competent enough to know how to spell BGP, right?
Or count to six.
Right. And know what IPv6 is, which, you know, I'd be so bold as to say those are less common than people may think.
Hey, MSPs have provided a lot of good service, and I really hate to malign them, but you're absolutely right. Very few of them actually get what they need to in order to be able to provide in this type of world.
It's an uncommon thing.
Yeah. But they're working on the common denominator. I've worked for one in the 90s. I did a bunch of work at an MSP. Ironically for service providers, but you know, that's not the norm, right? No, normally it's, hey, I have this Windows server and like 15 desktops, come in, make sure they're patched, whatever. I need a new switch, put in some Unify gear, whatever, right? You know, you have the big time ones, like, you know, like Kevin, and you know, they build the service providers. Like, they know what they're doing, clearly, right? People that have listened to this show have heard Kevin talk. He's very smart, and all his guys are smart too.
Okay. You have convinced me BGP is not the right way to do this.
Well, hang on. Let me give you yet another reason, right? Wow, and this is the one.
But wait, there's more.
So
if you act now, an ice pick.
So in running BGP, let's just say everybody can run BGP, right? Mm-hmm. Every mom and pop shop, every bakery, every clothing outlet, whatever, they're all going to run BGP. What does that do to the global routing table?
Oh, come on. That's easy. That's just like a couple extra billion ASNs.
Right.
Maybe like, I don't know, 2 or 3 billion ASNs.
You mean we would be taking a hierarchical network that we use to do some really cool things and shoving all of the control plane into a central.
Well, there's no way that would fragment anything, right, John?
That would be all right.
Yeah. I know of folks that still have, you know, fairly old gear running BGP that have some filtering in there, and that's totally fine. If it works for them, that's great. But when you start to explode the routing table, the global routing table, to a degree, you know, of orders of magnitude with 128-bit addressing, that melts down. I mean, it melts down the internet. Like, it won't scale, right? Someone will have to come up, then there'll be more creative ways to do filtering, and then it's just a, you know, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria. Like, it won't work. Did you catch that Ghostbusters reference there, John?
That was
for Jay too. That's a 1980s movie reference.
So what you're really telling me is if we turn around and give all these endpoint networks a single identifier and try and route based on that identifier, maybe like in a Lisp world or something like that, we still have too many things to keep track of in the global scheme.
It's a resource allocation problem. That's always what it comes down to. It's people, it's money, it's technical, it's always resources, right?
Can we fix it with SD-WAN? Everything's fixed with SD-WAN, I think.
Tunnels. Give me tunnels. I want more tunnels.
So it's funny that you say that, because the SD-WAN concept is almost exactly the way I was able to make this work at home. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is going to be a stretch here, but bear with me as we go on this. It's going to be a journey, Chris, not a CCIE journey. Ooh.
Can we make it a CCIE journey? Can we make it a MikroTik IE journey?
We'll make it a MikroTik journey because it definitely involves that. Okay, so I have these things at home. Let's harken back to 10 minutes ago when I was talking about trying to make this work at home. We've went through all the ways that I can't. John, for those listening, John is doing the Wayne's World with his hands. That's a 90s movie reference. All right. So I've got this setup at home. I have a /60 and a /56. I want these things to work. I want to have at least failover, right? So at this point, we're not even talking about anything other than just failover. We're not talking about load sharing. We're not talking about, you know, anything other than basically primary and secondary paths. Primary goes away, fails to secondary until primary comes back. That is doable. And the way that I was able to make that work is I took the first PA address of my primary, that PD, which, you know, gives me a 56. I assign those to all my downstream interfaces and thereby my hosts. So all my hosts get a slash, you know, out of a /64 from this larger 56 from the fiber provider. Those addresses never really need to change. Now, of course, if they get yanked because for whatever reason they time out, this sort of all falls apart. So even this is really just a house of cards. But if my primary goes away, I have those addresses on my host. I have it set up to where if upstream connectivity is lost and I still have a PD to my fiber provider, I will do a NAT66 out the point-to-point address that I get on my MikroTik to the DOCSIS cable modem. So I'm masquerading behind a single IPv6 address.
IPv6?
Yes, I am.
Oh,
the failover works.
Yep.
It only works until the timeouts happen. But for me, I never really have outages with my fiber provider. So it was really just an exercise to see if I could make it work. And I had to sort of synthesize the failures, but it does actually work. So, but it requires a NAT66.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, we've talked about a lot of like ways that it's supposed to work and kind of pieced those apart where they do work for some, where they might not scale globally, where they don't work in other ways and all that stuff. So I guess as we come up on 40 minutes here, you know, if we were to say, we came here to talk about a draft, and I know your draft is like outlining a lot of those things. Does your draft tell me how to fix it? Like, is there something I can like apt install to fix this? Like, please say yes. Oh, no. Nope.
It provides no solutions. All it does is point out, here are the options available that are deployable today and the pros and cons of each one. So it actually lays out like, these are the things that work well in the scenario, and these are the things that don't work so well.
So maybe one thing that is interesting about this draft then is like, it's not saying everything's broken for everything and there's no solutions for this. Because I think if anything has come from this discussion, it's been that there are a lot of solutions for this and they work really well in a lot of scenarios, but they don't work well for every scenario. And there are some, there is a union of, you know, of situations that you can have where none of these might work for you then, right?
Yep. And frankly, they're all fairly cumbersome to deploy.
Yeah.
So none of them are simple other than I have PI address space and I run BGP. That is the easiest one out of all of them, assuming you know what all those terms are and how to run that protocol, which is also actually, that's laid out as, you know, a caveat.
Yeah. So is it a better idea to turn around and be a provider that, you know, maybe hands you a 48 out of a data center someplace and we use a couple of tunnels to get to you? And, you know, you're buying connectivity from me, your upstream provider who doesn't change numbers, but you're utilizing two or three ISPs to get to it.
Go back to the dial-up days, really, right? You know, you just dial your provider with a tunnel and send your traffic there. That's what I do for V6, actually, at home. I use American Electric's tunnel broker. And I recently was brought onto a fiber ISP. Sorry, Comcast. Bye-bye. So even when I was on Comcast, which has native V6 and it's not bad, I still used a tunneling provider just because of basically all the reasons we've talked about here. And now that I've gone to this fiber ISP, like I am starting to kind of feel some of the pain of that in a way, because now my V4 is actually significantly faster than my V6 just because of the limits of being on a tunnel. And that kind of stinks. Like I would like to fix that. And so like tunneling is definitely an approach, like, and I do use it. And like Nick mentioned with ZTVI and like the way that you've done it with, you know, PI space and stuff like that, that's also a, you know, a good approach, but man, it's not something that's accessible to everyone. And even though like tunnel broker has made it dead simple, like you can just copy and paste the config for whatever platform you're on and it just works. You know, it's still not perfect. Like you can't stream Netflix, on that. Like you're getting geo blocked. Like, And I think that if you were to, you know, pursue a solution like this for a broader audience, like that would inevitably fall prey to a lot of the same issues of like geo blocking and all this stuff that content providers do. And yeah, it really is a mess. that's what I'm hearing here. This is a mess, isn't it?
A bit of a mess. Yes. And you're right. I mean, so John, the tunneling, we're back to that. Right. I don't think we ever really left it. Right. Because there's still a lot of small mid-size ISPs that don't do V6.
And well, I don't think there's a lot of difference between those tunnels and the multi-protocol
PCGs, I mean,
or anything like that. The idea of somehow or another, the two endpoints need to be talking to each other and having things abstracted away so that they look and act and feel like they're talking to each other, be it at IP level, be it at a multi-protocol level, be it at, however you deal with that, we're trying to find a way to make sure that the end-to-end piece from application to application works. And, you know, we've built a lot of people around the idea that NAT works, but it doesn't work in bidirectional situations, which we're increasingly trying to find places that do that again.
Yes. And you know, frankly, I've done the testing. You know, I ran a zero-tier tunnel with public IP space to the local ZTVI node here, which is accessible via an exchange here that's local to us. So it's fast, but, you know, it's, you know, zero-tier doesn't have it's encrypted overhead, right? It's not going to be line rate. It'll probably even when they start exercising the hardware and the microtics, it'll still not be line rate because it's got encryption overhead. Yep. And it worked, and it was a thing. It was a fun experiment. I don't want to run like that in production. And frankly, an end user is not going to do that. I think really the biggest takeaway that if I could make any point at all, it's that the lack of this type of flexibility is one of the things that makes V6 painful to deploy. Like, it's great if we can get it out there. If you only have, you know, for 99% of users that say, I just want internet connectivity and I don't care if it's $50 a month, that's all I care about, right? Give them V6. Like John said, they should never know that they even have it. that's the whole point. Like, it shouldn't matter. Like, your cell phone, like, I hear all these people saying V6 is nowhere, nobody's using it. They're thinking like, oh, I don't have it at the hospital that I work at. Okay, sure, fine. You got some extra overhead with HIPAA requirements and all that nonsense. But guess what, buddy? You've been carrying around a phone in your pocket for 10 years that has had V6 on it. And don't tell me that you never use it and there's nothing out there that uses it, because every person in the United States is carrying around a phone that has freaking V6 on it. Not every person, but you know, most people that have a smartphone also have V6. That's how simple it should be. You shouldn't have to think about it. It should be easy to do. And right now we just don't have that. It should be easier than it is now. I shouldn't say it should always be like, you know, mindless to make work. All that would be ideal, right? Mm-hmm. It just it needs to be supportable. And right now we do not have a good option for that. There are no good options.
So is the draft that you've been working on, is its purpose to guide us, show us which ones to use, or is it more informational about what's going on today and letting people know what some of their options are?
Yeah, it's B. It's informational, let people know what their options are, what's available today, because frankly, this information is not very well traveled, yeah. Right? There is, I've never found anything that says if I want to do multi-homed IPv6, but I don't have BGP, how do I do that? Yeah. I've never seen it anywhere else. Maybe it exists. Maybe it probably does. I've never seen it. So, you know, we wrote this thing up, and again, it's still like, we're working on like -01 right now version of it. So it's pretty new, but it gets the point across.
Yeah. And I really like the section around stateful NAT. I think that's an important one too. Cause like that one, it's not a great solution, but it is a pretty flexible solution. And I do like that it's been pulled out, you know, in your draft that, you know, the IAB doesn't want us to have NAT and V6, right? And like ITF overall has been incredibly resistant to having a stateful NAT engine in V6. But I think it is important, and that's what I like about this draft, it points out that people are doing it. And one thing I've said often in kind of the context of this ITF and V6 stuff, like, are, you know, and I didn't say this first, but like, you know, the, one of the common things is like, are we the protocol police, or are we the people that standardize what's, you know, being used out there and basically build things so that they can be used interoperably, right? And so I don't know that an outcome of this would be a success in my mind. I'm not saying that a stateful NAT 6.6 is that, but I would like to see perhaps minds opened up a bit, like within the ITF of just like, look, here's the real world. Like, I know that this is what we want IPv6 to do. I know that these are the desires and the goals and all that stuff. And that's great. But here's what's happening out there. And we need to provide solutions to people off that. So that's what I would like to see out of it. But I guess I'd ask you, like, what do you hope to see? Like, let's say this gets adopted and turns into an RFC and all that. Like, what would you hope that that does for the internet at large?
I mean, really what I hope will happen is that two things, that this will be useful for somebody first and foremost. Mm-hmm. Like, that's really all I care about, is that somebody reads this and they appreciate the fact that now I understand what my options are, right? That's all I really care about. But, you know, in a perfect world, you know, this sort of gets adopted and pushed out there officially as, you know, this is the informational draft that, you know, says what's available today. And then it just gets updated over time, right? As things may change. But, you know, as a sort of side effect, what I'd really like it to do is to highlight the poverty of deployable and supportable options that a regular user has to do this. Sure, anybody can get a Linux box and make it do all kinds of unholy things, right? If you understand how to do that.
Right.
But my litmus test has always been, even when I, you know, back in the 90s working in an ISP, like, talk to the customer like you talk to your mother, assuming you like your mother, right? No. I want my mother to be able to have whatever this thing is. She's not technical, mm-hmm. right? Plug in two things. Cord goes this one, cord goes this one. Wireless, SSID is this. Bob's your uncle, right? Everybody's good. Everybody's happy. That's what I want to have really come out of this. And from the, I get why the IAB doesn't want, you know, doesn't want the stateful stuff in the middle there. Like there is that. And I remember the days, and I don't, you know, and if you go and look at any of the stuff that I've said over the last decade, like I'm not a big fan of address translation. It's a tool in the toolbox, right? I'll use it when it's useful. I'll put it away when it's not. I'll make sure it's clean, right? But like at the same time, I also think that we should think about it that way. Like it's out there. People use it. It is available in commercial products. The problem that I have with the attitude, and this is, again, this is an unpopular opinion within that group, and that's totally fine, right? I have played the role of heretic my entire life, and I will continue to do that until my life is done. But, you know, I would rather control the beast by, you know, identifying it and, you know, admitting it exists and maybe putting some guardrails around it officially, than just letting the beast go and wreck up the place unencumbered. Right. And that's how I see it. Like there's an RFC for NAT NPTV6. There's just no RFC for NAT6.6. And I think that the V6 Ops working group sees any creation of that as condoning it as okay. Whereas I don't see it that way. Like I see it as, there's a tornado out there and I know where it is, right? If I point to the tornado, then other people will see where it is and they can either run into the tornado or they can run away from the tornado, right?
Yeah. You're saying this is an EF5 ambivalent tornado. It's built this way. Like it, you know, when these weather patterns happen, it comes together to do this. Like, yeah, right. It's not, yeah, there's no morality defined within a protocol. And that I feel like is constant frustration I see with standards bodies, is that there is like right and wrong assigned to protocols versus these things exist.
Right. I like to take the more Boba Fett approach, like just get the job done. I'm not good. I'm not bad, but I'll do whatever I need to do.
I like that. That's really good. Well, so we're at 50 minutes. Any closing thoughts real quick before we wrap it?
I don't think so. Nice. I've said my piece.
John, I think we've wandered a few places that have, you know, they're probably trodden upon more often than we really want them to be, but they need to be talked about and looked at a little more closely. I'm not a big fan of NAT, but I sure like network address translation a lot better than having to put a proxy up for every single application at the edge of my network. I'd rather have, I mean, if I'm going to put some stateful stuff in there, I might as well do it in one place that works simply with everything. Mm-hmm. I would much rather have the ability to, you know, signal out, I want some private spaces. I mean, I want some globally routed space to be brought all the way to my endpoint, and another way to, you know, be able to signal traffic that can be proxied out. You know, we're looking for simplification of things. If we had a way to do both of those, we might very well be able to solve a number of these issues, but we're trying to figure out how to deal with the complications of how do you give them that, how do you give people that non-stateful position all the way to the endpoint without making everyone run BGP?
Yeah. And I guess like, I guess maybe my closing thoughts are like, I would like to see that this draft perhaps at least spurs enough conversation. And I hope that people are willing to listen to it enough to, you know, actually discuss like and identify and acknowledge these are problems. 'Cause that's step one, right? Is like, okay, we have a problem. What is the problem? What are the possible solutions? And just identify that, start there. And then I really hope that this spawns off better discussion, because there's so many smart people involved on these lists and not on these lists, you know, listen to the podcast, like, you know, online on Mastodon or on, well, there's probably nobody smart left on Twitter, but like, you know, there's a lot of smart people left out there. Right. And like, I would hope that perhaps people could get together, talk about this and come up with like a novel solution for how we could fix this without blowing up routing tables, without having to break end to end and like all this stuff. Like, you know, we're engineers, we're smart. I'm sure we can figure something out. And, you know, I get afraid that these turn into such religious debates and dogmatic debates that people kind of close their minds to solutions. And yeah, hopefully this spurs things on. Well,
I did have one thing to say. Like,
yeah,
I will always say this. It's that I am not making an assumption that I'm 100% right about any of these things, or right at all. Like, I could be completely wrong. If I am wrong about that, please reach out to me. I would love to learn whatever is correct. I will be happy to amend any of the statements that I've made based around me being incorrect. So the end goal really is to produce something useful that someone can use on a day-to-day basis that makes their life a little bit better, makes their work life or whatever, right? Their entertainment, however you want to, you know, frame it. But, you know, hit us up. Like, yeah, let me know. I'm happy to be wrong as long as I learn something.
I like it. What a good place to end. And I'm also happy to say that Nick's probably wrong. So, all right. Well, hey, thank you everyone for listening to this episode of Modem. Again, season 3, episode 2. I'm talking about multi-homing IPv6. We've got John Osmond. John, you want to give us a little info about yourself?
John, let's see. I'm in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We would love to have, I'm gonna kind of poke something right now that we're having a NOG meeting here, ABQ NOG on May 4th. It's 2023, in case you listen to this and, you know, in the year 3000, it's too late for you to show up. But if anybody wants to show up, please do. We're going to be May 4th in Albuquerque, abqnog.org.
Nick, how about yourself?
I'm Nick Baraglio. You can find me here, modem.show, or on Mastodon at forwardingplane at dial.modem.show, or on Twitter at forwardingplane. And I have a blog that I never update anymore. It's at forwardingplane.net.
Very nice. And I'm Chris Cummings. You can find me on Mastodon, Verse, whatever they call it, at crankynetman at riceroni.org. I think I do have a Twitter still at crankynetman. /64.tech is my blog, and always on modem.show. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for tuning into the Modem Podcast, where yesterday's modems are today's transponders. For more information or to request a topic, please visit modem.show.